Well, look, the reason I've gathered you all together is for two purposes. One, the formal purpose here is to turn oversight of the Recovery Act over to Jack Lew at OMB. And I should point out, OMB has been up to their knees and eyeballs in this from the beginning. They have done an incredible amount of work. But now the good news is, Jack, I'm not going to be doing it. So, and they're going to be very relieved, because I think I've called like 15 or 17 cabinet meetings. So, but that's the first purpose. But the other purpose is to discuss the new report you all have in your hands that you all are responsible for, entitled "A New Way of Doing Business: How the Recovery Act is Leading the Way to 21st Century Government." Kind of ponderous title, but the bottom line is that we said at the outset, as we all recall, that our purpose here wasn't just to implement the act well, it was to try to come up with a new way of doing business. The President meant what he said when he was running. He's meant what he said since we've been President and Vice President, that we want to streamline government. We want to make sure that the consumers, our taxpayers, get the best bang for the buck that's out there. So when we passed the Recovery Act after taking office, in the midst of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, we laid out two goals. One was to save or create jobs today, and the second one was to lay a foundation, a stronger foundation for long-term prosperity for the next decade and beyond. And we also committed that we were going to do it right and do it well, and to make sure that every dollar that we were spending, and there had never been one single program this big, every dollar that we were spending was accounted for, and every official that we dispensed dollars to was held accountable. And the whole purpose of this was to sort of begin to sort of reinstill some confidence in the American people that the government knew how to do business and do it well, and also to make it clear that we were going to cut out waste and fraud to a degree that has never occurred before in something this large an undertaking, so the public resources would go exactly where they were supposed to go. Our critics, to say the least, were very doubtful that we'd be able to pull this off. that we could do it. They said we couldn't efficiently and effectively distribute all the money. We weren't likely going to get it out on time. We weren't likely to get it in the right places, and we couldn't do it without massive amounts of fraud and abuse and waste. We all committed then, and I committed when I started overseeing this act, that in 2 years. I mean, some of you remember, and I know all the cabinet members aren't here, but their deputies are, and a lot are here as well. We also collectively set a goal. It wasn't my idea. We all sort of, it all dawned on us that we hoped that if we did this as well as we thought we could, as transparently and accountably as we thought we could, it may become a new template for how we go forward and how we spend government money, how we manage the public resources. And I think you'll find in this report that I know you know it, but I think the press will find, the public will find, our friends in Congress will find that that we, in fact, have met our goals, and we've kept the commitments that we made from the outset. After 2 years of implementing the Act, more than 75,000 individual projects, as well as tax relief for millions upon millions of families and businesses, as well as countercyclical relief to the states and localities on FMAP and a number of other things. But there were 75,000 individual, essentially, contracts made for specific projects to do specific things. And I think we can show, and everyone now acknowledges, we not only created jobs across the country, we also spurred some economic growth in new and emerging industries. The seed money we put down brought capital off, private capital off the sideline. And we did it, I think you did it, responsibly, accountably, and with a level of transparency that I don't think has ever been seen at the national level. And I asked Earl Devaney, who's at the end of the head table here, who was, when the president labeled me the sheriff, I wanted to get the best enforcer there existed in the government. You think I'm kidding? I'm not. And it was there was a unanimous pick from everyone, Democrat, Republican. I asked about who should be the guy, the enforcer here. It was Earl. And he heads up, as you all know, but I want to make sure, remind the public and the press, a thing called the Recovery Act Transparency Board. That's a fancy way of saying he went out and got 12 other inspectors general. Their job was to go out there. These are the enforcers, go out there and provide, make sure that we provided the transparency that would not only identify fraud when it occurred, but prevent it from occurring in the first place. And this is probably some of the toughest group of watchdogs that we have put in place in the history of the government. And I want to thank Earl for his willingness to take this on. Earl, you've done an incredible job. It's amazing when I love him and Chairman Issa likes him too, so I don't know. but all kidding aside, we're actually working with Chairman Issa on using these models we put in place as a template to go forward. So this is a bipartisan undertaking, and we hope it's going to result in an awful lot of good work. And I've asked Earl to talk at when I finish these comments about the extraordinary effort that was undertaken, not just detecting fraud as it happens, but doing something to he's changed the template, he's changed the paradigm, and that is that we're trying to figure out how to prevent it before it takes place. And to describe some of the modern tools and technology that he used to do this commitment. Look, the thing I love about this guy is he went out and he went and looked at other agencies. He looked at everything from the CIA to the FBI to enforcement agencies. What tools do they use? What modern tools within the confines of our commitment to the Constitution and privacy are there available to us to be able to spot? You know, the women and men committing fraud, it's a very different deal than when I first got here. In the mid-70s. They've used the tools, the new technology tools, in ways that have been able to reach in and scoop up over time, both in the private sector and public sector, you know, tens of millions of dollars in fraudulent activity. Well, what I ask girls, find out how we can use those tools in a way that other agencies use them to be able to detect it before it happens. And although Earl will go into more detail, I believe the effort of the board is paying off in a big way for the American taxpayer. Just a few statistics. Since we started this thing 2 years ago, as I said, there's more than 75,000 individual projects with more than 250,000 cash awards. In other words, these contractors had subs and subs, and so there's literally 250,000 companies or individuals who benefited in terms of getting paid for work done for the public. That was a starting line. And in this time, over these 2 years, we've received fewer than 5,400 complaints of wrongdoing. And by the way, as you know, you all know the website, how extensive that website was. So we essentially had about 200 million adult Americans signed on to be watchdogs with us. They could click on and find out where that crosswalk at 2nd and Main, which was costing $187,000 in contract, or, you know, the Smith Contracting Company, which was supposed to do this with this material. It's amazing. Everybody knew what was going on in their neighborhood, and they were looking. And here we had a total of 5,400 complaints of wrongdoing. They're literally the calls that have come in from everywhere in the country, from agency inspectors generals to agency inspector generals about, hey, I don't think I don't think they're doing what they said they were going to do. And I just looked on the website and saw it was supposed to be done. As it turns out, of these 5,400 complaints or allegations of wrongdoing, less than 1,400 have resulted in active investigations or deeper review. And that means when the complaint came in, and Earl explained this, when the complaint came in, the inspectors general took a look. Is there anything to this? So they do the first scrub and work it through the process to determine how far to take it. Fewer than 1,400 result in active investigations and deep review. Of these, less than 1,000 are still being reviewed, but the review of the remaining 400 or so has been completed. And as you all know, the majority of those 400 completed cases were closed without action. Only 45 have resulted in a conviction, settlements, or pleas and judgments. So, folks, in order to get the magnitude of this, 45 convictions, settlements, pleas, judgments so far out of 250,000 cash recipients of federal money. That doesn't mean that this is all going to continue to go well. We're, as Earl constantly reminds me, it ain't over till it's over. It ain't over till every penny has been spent and accounted for. But thus far, it's a pretty good deal. An equally startling figure to me is we asked DOJ to tell us how many dollars were involved in the cases in which they have filed charges. The answer is not even $3 million of the cases that are worth pursuing that are out there, $3 million out of $475 billion in contracts let. I can say without fear of contradiction, that has never occurred before. Never occurred before at this level. So no matter which way you cut it, the fraud so far has been remarkably low. Any fraud is a problem, but it's less than 1% of all the money out there that's been distributed. And through all this, it was also important that we stay in close contact with the mayors and the governors and the county executives who really were the ones making all this work. And I would say on balance, speaking for myself, I think Republican and Democrat alike out there were remarkably efficient in what they did. Now, granted, I was probably the least popular guy with governors and mayors, but the truth of the matter is I hosted over with the help of this staff in here, over 75 of these calls, and sometimes with you principals sitting next to me on the speakerphone, that averaged about, on balance, about once a week for literally an hour and a half or so. And as a consequence, I've spoken to, I think, every governor but one, and I've spoken to almost every one of them two or more times for more, on average, an hour. Literally, we'd get 7 to 10 governors on the phone, Democrat and Republican. And, what we said was, look, it's not good enough that you meet the letter of the law. It has to pass a smell test. So, for example, one mayor had an idea for a Frisbee golf thing. Well, it would have created jobs. It would have done, but it just didn't pass a smell test. And remember, we saw on television that and then they later said after they showed it that we already cut it, we didn't do it, a polar bear park. Remember that whole thing? We started getting all kinds of calls. Well, these governors knew that, and I was very blunt. I said, guys, look, I don't want to be the bad guy, but if you screw up, I'm going to call a press conference and say you screwed up. I'm going to say the governor of, I'm not going to name a city, but the governor of a state or the mayor or the county executive, they went ahead and did the following, and it was a mistaken use of the money. And so they were very good, and they ended up, we learned a lot from them. We learned a lot from them as they were saying, look, we're having trouble implementing this way, and then we'd go to OMB and say, can you help us with the regulations? So the point is that I think we also set another standard that is going to be difficult but necessary for you all to follow up on. I made a commitment, and you made the commitment with me, that any elected official working with any one of our agencies, if they had a question, we would get them an answer in 24 hours. I defy the press to find anybody out there working for any of the Recovery Act projects where we were unable to get them an answer in 24 hours. And I'd say, if we don't have the answer, we'll call you within 24 hours and tell you why we don't have the answer and when we'll have the answer. And I know that put an incredible burden on all of you, but I hope it's now part of the ethic of how we operate. Because if you notice, this, there's much complaint about how this act really didn't do what it was supposed to do, and it did. You didn't hear that coming from Republican governors or Republican mayors or Democratic county executives, because we were responsive. You were responsive. And so, at my request, the administration has held more than 300 events, seminars, and sessions. You've held them around the country to ensure as well we kept another commitment, that small businesses and minority-owned firms and veterans would actually be able to get in on and compete for these contracts. I don't think it's that the agencies in the past have deliberately avoided small businesses or avoided minority firms. It's just easier. You know, you get the big guy, he's used to doing it, he's used to working, he comes and, well, let's go get it done. And you guys went out and you came up with lists of the small businesses, lists of minority contractors in the area, and you let them know that they're available to bid on this. And so it really has had an impact. In addition to those 300 events, we also encourage agencies to send their top brass, Senate-confirmed officials, mayors, cabinet officials, to attend several of the small and minority business matchmaking events, as we call them. It paid off. We far exceeded the government-wide small business contracting goal of 23%. We did it. More than 31% of these contracts went to small business. And many of these small disadvantaged businesses, women and veteran-owned small businesses, minority-owned, our support allowed them to play a vital role in spurring the growth and producing jobs in communities that were in the greatest need. The next thing we set out to do, and I realize this is long, but it's by definition, it's necessary for us to lay out exactly whether or not we met what we said we were going to do. The whole process, you, and I'm, and particularly this guy to my right, kept talking about the need for collaboration, eliminating stovepipes, you know, and I said to you one time, well, the housing thing, you said, well, I went over and talked to Ray. You know, I need DOT to be able to get a bus line or a trolley line to this housing project to get to a job. I mean, I found, and I've been here a long time, more coordination and breaking down these stovepipes than I've seen at any time. And I think we can show that. And again, the bad news for you all is we've now set a standard that we got to continue throughout this administration. We also wanted to foster competition. There were two goals we laid out in the beginning for very simple reasons. When you collaborate, it means you cut cost, increase efficiency, and when you foster competition, it means the public gets the best product for the cheapest amount that they can get it. One of the byproducts of this was the contract bids in some cases came in somewhere between 6% to 20% below expected costs. And in fact, 3,000 extra projects, a lot of them land in Ray's jurisdiction, 3,000 extra projects were able to get done because of the original projects came in billions of dollars under budget. And again, created more jobs, expanded more infrastructure, produced more for the public. Collaboration and competition have been critical to the Recovery Act's success, and they work so well that we believe they should be applied in the future all across all government agencies. And the budget the President presented last week, and with Jack's helpful hand here, has woven into it these notions. You're going to hear from Secretary Donovan and Chu and LaHood, as well as Melanie Barnes, from the Domestic Policy Council on behalf of Arne Duncan, who is at another, when we changed the time, he was unable to attend, how we are engaging in collaboration and competition, and how we fuse these lessons into the present budget submitted and how we want to go forward. Secretary Donovan is going to talk about how collaboration across the agency helped cut through red tape that often bogs down government programs. And Melanie, along with Secretary Chu and LaHood, they're going to speak about how we're fostering more competition to make sure that taxpayers' money goes to making sure the public gets the best bang for their buck. And let me just briefly mention that in education, we're applying the successful Race to the Top competition awards that were contained in the Recovery Act. That rewarded districts with ambitious reforms to elementary and secondary education. We're launching the first in the world competition to increase college access and competition. In energy, you're going to hear from the Secretary, we're using the Race to the Top model to give communities an incentive to invest in infrastructure we need to meet the goals of having, for example, 1 million electric vehicles on the road, the first country in the world to do that by 2015. And through the Recovery Act, we've proved that the government can move quickly and get the job done and do it right. We're gonna need to follow these lessons in future budget and implementation efforts if we're going to live up to what we've done in the Recovery Act. Now, a lot has been made of the President, as I said, tapping me to be Sheriff Joe, which my colleagues, former colleagues, just thought was a hoot when he said it. And by the way, it's the first time I heard it, too. But, you know, I'm going to let you know that I'll be pinning that badge on Jack in a minute. A capable, more than capable successor. He doesn't have much else to do anyway. And so Sheriff Jack's going to be doing this from this point on. And Jack's going to handle in his outfit the day-to-day management of the Recovery Act going forward. Seeing as he just released the budget Monday, I figure he needed something new to do because he's got that done now. But the truth is, OMB, as I said, has been deeply, deeply involved, as much as any cabinet department around here in the Recovery Act to begin with. So I'm going to turn this over now for brief remarks in the following order: to Jack, then to Earl, then to Secretary Donovan, then to Melanie, and then to Secretary Chu and LaHood. And I'll make some very brief closing remarks. But Jack, congratulations, man. You got my badge. It's all yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vice President. I will take the badge proudly and the title. I want to personally thank the Vice President and his team for the leadership that they've shown over the last 2 years since the Recovery Act passed. Under this leadership, the Recovery Act has created the kind of economic stimulus that it was designed to provide, but as importantly, it's been executed in a remarkable and unprecedented way with the kind of efficiency and effectiveness that we should look forward to seeing in the future, both as we go forward here and in other government programs. OMB and the Vice President's office have been engaged over these 2 years in a productive partnership on the Recovery Act, really since the very beginning. And that partnership will continue. As of today, OMB will be taking over on a greater day-to-day basis the leadership role in implementing it. And Danny Werfel, who is the OMB controller and has been OMB's day-to-day point person on the Recovery Act, has done a great job, will continue. And there will be that kind of continuity of leadership, and he will continue in that role, helping me as I wear the new badge to at least try to do as well as the prior sheriff. In order to build on the success of the Recovery Act, implementation to date, it's important that all parties maintain kind of strict vigilance in sticking to the level of transparency and accountability that we've looked to over the last 2 years. Today, we have over 99.6% of recipients complying with their reporting requirements. That's about as close to 100% as you can get. And this means that transparent information is available to the public, and less than 0.4% of awards are being cited for the kinds of waste, fraud, and abuse that we worried about at the beginning. Again, that's as close to perfect as you can get. We still want to do better, but that's a pretty good record. These efforts can't wane until every dollar has been spent and every project is finished. In addition, we'll focus on making sure that the lessons learned from the Recovery Act and that the Vice President has talked about are carried forward and used to improve program performance across the government. I think it's very important that we've taken the Race to the Top principle and applied it to other programs. As the Vice President already discussed, and there are also issues in terms of transparency and general oversight that will go forward and be applied to other agencies. As Recovery Act projects continue to ramp through the process and the spending by recipients continues, the audit community, the IGs, the Inspector Generals, the GAO, will and should continue careful oversight of the programs. It's critical work in protecting the integrity of the program and ensuring that implementation remains free from waste, fraud, and abuse. In addition, we're focused on making sure that we take advantage of the new ways and lessons learned that the Vice President discussed. One such area that I'd like to emphasize is program integrity, where we're committed to using the lessons learned during the Recovery Act to drive down error and fraud in other government programs. We'll be hearing more about this important area in a few minutes from Earl Devaney, but I'd like to say just a few words about the importance of the progress we've made in this area. Last spring, Mr. Vice President, you announced that the administration would look for opportunities to build on the success of the Recovery Board's cutting-edge fraud detection tool and expand activities beyond the Recovery Act. And we completed a successful pilot of the Recovery Board tool at Department of Health and Human Services and CMS, and we're now piloting the tool at the Veterans Administration. We're now looking to initiate an even broader expansion of this technology by making it part of our Do Not Pay List solution. The President's 2012 budget proposed to significantly strengthen the power and scope of our current Do Not Pay List by adding forensic technologies that are proving successful in the Recovery Board approach. The Do Not Pay solution is part of a larger set of program integrity proposals that are all in the President's 2012 budget that he presented on Monday. And if enacted, we project that it would provide $160 billion in savings over 10 years, which even in the jaded era of billions and trillions is still a lot of money. So in short, Mr. Vice President, I take over this responsibility with humility and confidence that we will continue to do the good work that you have done, and we'll look forward to your continued counsel as we go forward.
Thanks, Jack. Look, Earl, I want to hear from Earl now. You know, all the years as a senator, the easiest thing people do when they try to deal with budget crises is to just cut waste, fraud, and abuse. That was sort of code word for we're not going to make any hard decisions, but we never got the money we thought we could get from cutting. This guy has done is he has used new tools that we really, when you say cut waste, fraud, and abuse, it's really, really happening. Stick to it. You can make the savings tag you talked about. If you had said to me, Joe Biden, the first guy, the vice president, and said we're going to be able to cut what was 160 billion over 10 years, I'd look and say, Jack, I heard that.
And have a bridge.
And I've embraced the sun. Right. But I think actually Earl has demonstrated that it's possible if we stay the course. I'm sorry I didn't have my mic on, but you didn't miss a thing. Earl, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vice President. I'm trying to figure out if there are any badges left.
That's right.
I'd like to get one of those.
That's right.
I want to.
I may have been a sheriff, but you've been the marshal.
I want to thank you, Mr. Vice President, and echo Director Liu's remarks about your leadership in this recovery implementation. It's been just terrific to be part of that team and to watch you perform that leadership. And I also want to thank you for the commitment you made in your office about 2 years ago to me personally about doing everything in your power to help both me and the rest of the board succeed in our mission. And as I look back on the last 2 years, you've done a great job at that, and I really want to thank you, from the bottom of my heart for that one. And thank everybody else in the room. We worked from, as mentioned earlier, day one with OMB, and that partnership and collaboration has led to the successes we've had, as well as everybody else, every other agency represented in this room. We've worked very well, and I think the collaboration has been terrific. And as I look back on my, I think I'm in my 41st year in federal government, I quite frankly can't remember a team effort across government on one single activity that is a better example of teamwork than this one. Our mission was twofold, as has been mentioned. We were to handle the transparency piece of the Recovery Act and set up a public-facing website. and also to prevent fraud, waste, and abuse of the recovery monies. Both of those missions are fraught with challenges and high risk. And I remember testifying up on the Hill in the spring and the summer of 2009, I think with some false bravado, that we would be able to pull all that off by October of 2009, a mere 5 months. So in fact, we did stand up two websites in that time frame. One website called federalreporting.gov captures the data that the recipients send us, and the other website, recovery.gov, actually displays the data. So that today, American citizens can go on recovery.gov and drill down into their own zip codes, congressional districts, counties, and see exactly where the recovery monies have gone in their neighborhoods. And that is I would stipulate that probably certainly meets the mandates of the Recovery Act and brings a new level of transparency to government that hasn't been here before. The second mission of the Recovery Board, the fraud, waste, and abuse part, is perhaps a little bit more intuitive to a group of 13 IGs than building websites. But from the very beginning, the IG community took the position that we had to do things differently with this amount of money. This was an awful lot of money, and I think rightfully so. Predictions were that sophisticated criminals would come and look for this money. So we actually changed the paradigm in the IG community and moved away from the traditional audits and investigations that sort of are the hallmarks of detecting fraud, waste, and abuse, and moved the ball to the front end of the fraud spectrum to try to prevent fraud, waste, and abuse from happening in the first instance, or at least interrupt it in the middle of the losses so that we could prevent the whole amount of money going down the street. So to do that, the Recovery Board developed something that we call the Recovery Operations Center, which is located in our headquarters across the street. And that center has a whole bunch of bright young analysts and sophisticated analytical tools, as the Vice President mentioned, we got from other government agencies that are using them principally in the counterterrorism and the law enforcement world. And the novelty of our Recovery Operations Center is we're using these old tools in a new way on government spending, and it's working out very well. We're actually preventing fraud from happening in the first place. We're interrupting fraud in the middle of somebody trying to take it or waste it. And, of course, we are detecting fraud after it's also lost. So there has been fraud. There will continue to be fraud, but nowhere near what the pundits and skeptics predicted. And I always knock on wood and say that we've been able to keep this fraud to a minimum, and I think it's because of this paradigm shift in a new way of thinking for IGs. Going forward, we need to improve the websites, as we try to do every month. We need to look for new tools for our Recovery Operations Center that can help us detect fraud and prevent fraud. And we need to figure out how we institutionalize some of these strategies and tools in government as we move forward. Mr. Vice President, you and I have talked about this as being a template for the future. And I've heard you mention that term in many of your speeches. And I think we are hard about right now trying to get a position paper developed that talks about how we actually do that. As mentioned earlier, we've done some pilots in the Recovery Operations Center on Medicare. We're doing one on VA. We're going to do more in the future. All of that has led us to believe that the tools and strategies we're using on recovery monies are just as applicable to other kinds of government spending and other kinds of government activities. So we're very encouraged by that. Finally, I think I would be remiss today if I didn't mention what I believe to be the most positive residual benefit of the Recovery Act. And that's the positive relationship that's developed between agencies and inspector generals. It turns out if the common goal is to detect fraud, waste, and abuse, understandably, IGs come to the table very enthused and aggressively, and agencies sort of take a back seat. It's, after all, the IG's job to do that. But when we change the goal to preventing fraud, waste, and abuse, my observation is that both parties come to the table with equal enthusiasm. And that has been wonderful to see. And all over government, agencies and IGs who normally have a healthy degree of tension amongst them are working collaboratively to bring this off. So I'm going to end on that positive note.
Well, let me I just can't resist telling a little story. Earl, when I recommended Earl to the president and the president appointed Earl, it was clear Earl was not within my jurisdiction. As everybody pointed out, it's Earl's money. He was, for real, I had no authority over telling Earl what to do or not to do. And he was sitting in a chair next to me in my office. I said, Earl, I'd like to ask you a favor. I said, as soon as you detect any waste or fraud, I said, would you let me know? Because I'd like to announce it. And he looked at me and said, what did you say? I said, I would like to get ahead of the curve and announce where we're wasting money. And he looked at me and said, that's a novel idea. So thank you, Earl, for all you're doing. Okay, Sean, we take the floor, please.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk a little bit about how under your leadership, HUD has been part of not only putting people back to work today, but also helping us win the future. There was that memorable line the president talked about, the agency that focuses on salmon when it's in freshwater and salmon when it's in saltwater is a different agency. There might be another agency for smoked salmon. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Well, this is about creating collaboration and coordination across agencies to help us change the way government does business. And I want to talk about three examples of that. And I particularly want to recognize all of my colleagues here. You've put together a remarkable, remarkable team. It's been just a great pleasure working with them on this this endeavor. And I also want to say it's not just about collaborating among federal agencies. It's also about creating a new relationship between federal government and local government, and also federal government and the private sector. So the first example I want to talk about, over the last 2 years with my colleague Steve Chu, HUD has partnered with the Department of Energy to coordinate $5 billion in Recovery Act funds to weatherize homes and help American families reduce their energy costs. It's a key part of our goal to out-innovate our competitors around the world by building a new green economy. But historically, only 8% of weatherization funds have reached multifamily apartments for low-income renters, even though they make up, low-income renters make up a far larger share of all low-income people in this country. And about a third of those apartments that we've reached before were subsidized directly by HUD. Thanks to the collaboration we had with Department of Energy, we are about to double that number to reach, with this funding, 20% of the 600,000 homes this program will weatherize by March 2012. Will be multifamily apartments. How did we do that? In a number of ways, but most simply, what we found out when we looked at this is that we went in and measured the incomes of families living in these apartments every year, and then Steve's team would have to go in and measure the incomes to give them the grant. We said, hey, why don't we just do it once? Make it faster, make it simpler, and it's that's been a key thing that's led to getting this number from 8% to 20% already. And the best thing about this is that HUD spends about $1 billion a year on utilities in these apartments. And when you invest in weatherization, typically in 3 to 5 years, you pay back the investment that you make up front through savings in utilities. So this collaboration isn't just about getting to the right people faster, it's also about saving us money. Second example I want to give is not only about collaborating with federal agencies, but also with local government. We created in the Recovery Act a new innovative flexible tool called Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing. And this new initiative has already helped us, with our local partners, prevent or end homelessness for more than 875,000 people around the country. And what's remarkable about this is the way it's changed our approach to homelessness. Just as you heard Earl Devaney talk about preventing fraud, well, it turns out it's much more cost-effective and better for the people we help to prevent homelessness before it happens rather than to wait for them to end up in a shelter. And so we've done that with local government. We surveyed recently, two-thirds of mayors around the country said that this program alone had fundamentally changed their approach to homelessness. It's been particularly effective, as you know, Mr. Vice President. Dr. Biden has been very involved with us in our fight to end veterans' homelessness. It's a national tragedy that veterans are 60% more likely than the average American to be homeless. And one of our great tools to do this is something we're doing in very close collaboration with the Department of Veterans Affairs. We call it HUD-VASH, or Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing. It combines our vouchers, Section 8 vouchers, with VA's case management and clinical services. And this partnership, we knew when we came in at the beginning of the Recovery Act, was critical to ending veterans' homelessness. But at the time we started the Recovery Act, only 1,200 veterans around the country were benefiting. And one of the reasons, as we dug into this with VA, we found was that our rules were too rigid. We paid for rent, they paid for case management and other services, but oftentimes what stood between a veteran remaining in a shelter or getting housed was something as simple as a security deposit for an apartment. And because of the flexibility of our tool with our Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing Program, we were able to help those veterans get into apartments quickly and to end their homelessness. And today I'm happy to report to you that with this work that we've done together, there are nearly 20 times more veterans being housed today through this program, or 21,000 veterans that have homes today, thanks to the work that we've done with VA. And with a population, we just finished our first ever national survey, detailed survey of the number of homeless veterans. That number is under 100,000. And so when you reach 21,000 already, we're well on our way to meeting the president's goal of ending veterans' homelessness in 5 years. The third example I want to give is an example not just of working with federal agencies, but also working with the private sector and the nonprofits. One of our Recovery Act programs, the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, we distributed through a competition, and it's intended to help local communities hit by foreclosures renovate and resell those homes so they don't keep dragging down everyone else's property values in neighborhoods with high rates of foreclosure. What we found, however, with all of our different grantees, when they were trying to approach servicers individually, we had servicers who said, you know, we can't negotiate agreements with thousands of localities around the country. And what grantees were finding is there might be 8 or 10 different servicers on any block that they were trying to fix up. And if they couldn't get all the properties on that block, they weren't going to have the impact that they needed to have. So we joined with 5 national nonprofits. We signed up all the major financial institutions that account for 75% of all the foreclosures in the country, and made a deal to get a first look, we call it, for our grantees, a 12 to 14 day period where they're the only ones that could bid on it. And what we found is that 188 properties have been, in the first year of this partnership, able to not only access thousands of properties, but because of the time and the efficiency that we've gained in this process, they've saved $26 million in taxpayer funds, an average discount on those houses of 13% because they sell faster and more effectively. With us at the table, with our partnership with these groups in the private sector, we have been able to make a big dent to the point where we are seeing many neighborhoods with 50 to 75% reductions in vacancy rates that were suffering desperately just 2 years ago. Those are 3 examples of the collaboration. There are many more that all of my colleagues I know could give you as well, Mr. Vice President. But because of your leadership on this, I think we have shown the way to that reformed government that will help us win the future that the President talked about in the State of the Union.
Thanks, Sean. Director Barnes.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Vice President, for having us here, and I'm pleased to be here. I know Arnie is on a plane right now, but I'm pleased to be here to talk to you about competition, and particularly in the context of education and the Recovery Act. And to be honest, this is one of my favorite things to talk about in the administration. As we all know, we put a significant amount of money, a state fiscal stabilization funds out to ensure that teachers could stay in their classrooms, that other public officials, policemen, firemen could stay on their jobs as well. But at the same time, we hived off a small fraction, just 5% of our federal education investment, and we put that toward a program called Race to the Top. And we believe that Race to the Top has been a significant game changer in terms of education reform. It rests on four important principles. You know, one, that we wanted to make sure that the best teachers and leaders were in our schools for our children. Secondly, that those the bottom 5% of all schools, the schools that are significant dropout factories and are producing about 7,000 dropouts every day, that we were going to start turning those schools around. That we were also going to use data in a better way, which it sounds like something that's dry, but actually is something that's so important to when teachers on a day-to-day basis want to make sure that they're understanding where their students are and how they can adjust the way that they teach them to make sure that they're learning and that they're performing, and also so that parents can better understand what's going on with their children. And finally, we also wanted to make sure that we are better assessing how our children are doing in schools and that we're setting proper standards to make sure that they are indeed, as the president has said, ready for college and ready for career. So those are the four principles that Race to the Top sits on. And with that $4 billion, we said to the states, based on those four assurances, apply for this money and tell us how you can work with your communities to propel your school systems into the future, to make sure that students are in fact getting to the top, racing to the top, and we're producing the best schools in the country. We had 46 schools apply for those, 46 states and the District of Columbia apply for those funds. And ultimately, there are 12 states and the District of Columbia that became winners. And those 12 states comprise about 25,000 schools and about 13.6 million students, about 28% of our student population. And certainly those schools and those students are benefiting from those funds. And one of the things that we also saw in this process was the collaboration that it took as those states started to apply. And the very fact that teachers and teachers' unions, state superintendents, that the private sector, the philanthropic sector, political leaders from the state all sat around a table and said, how do we put the best possible application in so that we can win those funds and turn our schools around? That was a victory, and the benefits that are coming from those dollars are a victory for those students. But the other thing that we saw was that in states and the states that didn't win those dollars, that their students are winners too. And I'm not underestimating the power of those dollars, but in the states that didn't win, we also have seen laws change because they wanted to become more competitive. So in some states where they weren't allowing a linking of teacher evaluation and student growth, those laws are gone. In some states where they had caps on charter schools, those laws are gone. In states that had laws that were preventing school turnaround, those laws are gone, and even though those states don't have the dollars right now, the students are benefiting from that kind of reform, and we know those collaborations in many places still exist, and states are starting to work together, continuing to work together to produce the kind of reform that we think is important. So we recognize that, again, with that fraction of our federal education budget, that we have started an important and seeded an important reform movement all across the country. At the same time, we have been able to support the work of governors as they've come together with state school chiefs to talk about college and career-ready standards. This isn't something that we imposed from Washington. This is something that governors working together in a very concentrated effort have said, we have got to make sure that our kids are prepared for college and career. What does that mean? And now we've got over 40 states that have signed on to these college and career-ready standards. That kind of competition has really been the theory of the case for us in education and all across the budget in ways that my colleagues have described today. So if you look at our budget right now, we've got our First in the World Fund, another competition to make sure that we're enrolling and graduating students in college and we're reaching the president's goal of having the highest proportion of college graduates in the world. On the other end of the spectrum, you can see it in our competition for early learning to make sure that we're starting our youngest children out and we're producing quality early learning environments for them. And that list goes on, including a shift in race to the top that will allow school districts and not just states to apply, and a particular set aside for rural areas to make sure that we're touching children all across the country. So the list goes on. I'll stop there, except to say that this idea of competition has really propelled the reform movement, brought people around a table to collaborate in a way that they haven't before. And the best part of it is that our children have been the winners and will continue to benefit from this process and from those dollars. So thank you very much for
good
your work in making this.
Good things.
Yeah.
And by the way, I want to thank you all for not speaking federal bureaucraties and speaking in ways that average Americans can understand what we're doing. I think sometimes we get so wrapped up in what we're doing. If you went out and spoke to your neighbor about what you're doing and the way we talk about it, they'd wonder what we were doing. But thank you for doing that. Secretary Chu.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. I don't know whether that was a warning that I should keep it.
No. It was acknowledgement that the Nobel laureate in physics is able to speak to a guy like me and have me understand what he's talking about. That's what it was.
I think you have no problem understanding. Before I start, I just want to reiterate the transparency, the high reporting details that have really been a landmark of this program and under your leadership. When you think about it, at least 99.6% of the money we gave out does not have fraud, waste, and abuse. That's purer than ivory soap. That's 99.44% pure. So it's pretty good. In any case, I think from day one of the Recovery Act, the department goal was to get our money out the door quickly and effectively. Many of our grants, much of the money we were to award were competitively awarded grants. And I'll just give you one example. There was a new program that was started under the Recovery Act, Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy. In the first solicitation, which was offering less than 0.5% of the money in the Department of Energy, we received about 100,000 inquiries, 37,000 full proposals, and we decided in order to do this right, we would have to review these proposals by at least 3 independent people, which we gathered from the best that academia and industry had to offer. So there were 3,000 reviewers of those proposals, and of those 37,000 proposals, we could only award 37. But that was so successful that we invited back in the award ceremony not only the awardees, but the next tranche, the top 10%. And on the floor of this little symposium, the investment capital, the entrepreneurs were actually making deals with the silver medalists, if you would say, and with the award programs. Of those 37, they took the money, did some more research, and within 1 year, they were able to raise six companies, four times the amount of money initially given to them. And so this is really showing that this federal dollars were highly leveraged on how successful this is. And in fact, on average, if you look at all our major programs and our solicitations, we were oversubscribed 3 to 5 to 1. And this highlights the intense competition for funds and the eagerness of American innovators. We've also encouraged competition among technologies by supporting a broad portfolio of pathways to achieve a goal. We weren't picking winners or losers. We were letting the ingenuity of the great inventors in the United States and the innovation machine to say, come forward, and we'll try to select the best of those ideas. For example, through the Recovery Act, we invested about $2.8 billion in the development and deployment of advanced technology vehicles. These funds were met dollar by dollar by the private sector. 70 private companies and researchers, more than 30 states received grants, and the awardees were chosen through another rigorous and highly competitive process. And these awards are beginning to have impact. Before the Recovery Act was signed, we had almost no ability to manufacture advanced batteries in the United States. These are batteries that could power tomorrow's and today's plug-in hybrids and electric vehicles. And thanks to these investments, by 2014, the United States will have the capacity to produce 500,000 advanced battery vehicles per year. The Recovery Act investments were able to bring manufacturing back to the United States. Johnson's Controls and Compact Power decided they need to expand their manufacturing capability. They chose to expand it into the United States. Two other companies, A123 and SBE, were thinking of starting factories overseas, but because of the Recovery Act, they decided to make those factories in the United States. But the story is actually much better than that. If you look at these advanced batteries, but Mr. Vice President, if you'll allow me just a few more minutes to expand on this, that it has not directly something to do with the Recovery Act, but how investment in the scientific enterprise has led to directly to economic prosperity in the United States. The lithium-ion battery was in large part invented by scientists sponsored by the Department of Energy. That migration of the technology went over abroad to Japan. They took over the leadership in the manufacturing of these batteries. But more recently, we're getting back that leadership. The new Chevy Volt and its battery is based on improvements in that design that were made by Department of Energy scientists from Oregon National Laboratories. And they've been patented, a suite of patents. But it's even better than that, because those scientists who made those discoveries that are now in the battery technology of the Volt were using an instrument, a so-called light source, that the Department of Energy sponsored. And the core ideas of that light source actually grew out of high-energy physics. And no one would have thought that high-energy physics would have led the invention of a light source in the ultraviolet and the X-rays that could transform the way we do material science and drug discovery. In fact, it so transformed the way we do drug discovery that the NIH, the National Institutes of National Cancer Institute, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, have invested many hundreds of millions of dollars in experiments in those light sources. Those same experiments had led to the invention of a new material for a new battery that's now in the Volt. And so the continued investment in science will lead to payoffs, immediate payoffs that create further wealth in the United States. And this is what the president was calling for in his 2012 budget. This is how we win the future and continue to win the future. So in getting the most bang for a buck, I mean, we're taking these lessons of the Recovery Act, and as was mentioned before, imitation is the highest form of praise, and so we're taking, as Melanie said, our cues from Arne Duncan, the Department of Education, in their race to the top. And so for our FY12 budget, we're requesting $200 million for a new plug-in challenge. And so what does that mean? We're asking communities to compete, to come up with the most innovative programs and how to deploy electric vehicle charging stations in their cities. And we'll give up to 30 awards to cities and communities who propose the most creative and effective programs. So this will set off a little buzz. They're going to go figure out how to do it. And we think that we'll unleash that creativity, just as Race to the Top has unleashed the creativity in education reform. And deploying the electric vehicle infrastructure throughout a city is a large task. And that's why we're providing these incentives to local communities. Like the Race to the Top, we will grade the proposals and reward the most pioneering plans. We'll give the highest grades to communities that plan to cut the red tape, deploy EV infrastructure quickly, and leverage federal funds through local partnerships. And like Race to the Top, we believe the winning communities will serve as pace setters, providing ideas and best practices that other communities can adopt. And through this competition and others like that, we can and will reduce our dependence on foreign oil, grow our economy, and create good-paying jobs. And this is going to be a win for all of us. And so thank you, Mr. Vice President.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary, particularly for painting the picture what the spinoff effects of all this are. I mean, this is, we not only have to create new jobs, we have to create new industries. We have to create whole new enterprises. And let me close by asking Secretary LaHood, who he and I have probably traveled to more cities than he'd like to admit with this Recovery Act, but Ray, the floor is yours.
Thank you, sir. Let me add my thanks to you. The reason this program has been so successful is because of your extraordinary leadership. I don't think most of you know, during the Vice President's comments, he talked about talking to mayors and governors. And when I would travel around the country and I would see a governor or mayor, they had already talked to the Vice President. The Vice President, as you all know, has a lot of things to do, but to take this on, to get on the phone every day and to call three or four mayors and three or four governors to find out how things are going, then to convene meetings that we had here, and then to travel around the country, and the Vice President and I did travel around. The reason this program is successful is because of the Vice President, because he was stuck with it every day. He talked to people every day. The other reason it's successful is because we had great partners out in the country, in governors and in mayors and in other stakeholders who were just clamoring for opportunities to put their friends and neighbors to work. And the stimulus program worked. I don't care what anybody says. I don't care what anybody has written. The stimulus program has worked, and that's what we should be celebrating today. We really should be. Thanks to you, Mr. Vice President, but thanks to our partners out in the country. I'll just tell you, at DOT, we had $48 billion. 15,000 projects were funded that would not have been funded without this money. We know of 65,000 to 75,000 people who went to work building roads and bridges and infrastructure, building transit systems that would not have happened over the last 2 years without this money. The stimulus program worked. We ought to be proud of it. We ought to be proud that we put our friends and neighbors to work. We ought to be proud that that we have made investments that will last well beyond our careers in these jobs. We're trying to play off of that. And I might say, Jack, that your people at OMB have been with us all along, the career people and some of the political people. We couldn't have done a lot of this without your people. So handing this off to you is a perfect handoff, because your people have been with us hand in glove. Two people who aren't here that really, I think, deserve a lot of credit. One is Ron Klain and one is Ed DeSev. They've both gone on to bigger and better things, but they were enormously helpful to us. Ron for his political skills and Ed for just holding our feet to the fire every day on behalf of the Vice President's office. Now, we're going to carry this forth into the transportation bill that we hope Congress will pass this year. We want a bill on the President's desk by the August recess. We think it's doable. We think it plays off very well of what we've been doing for the last 2 years. And we have some creative approaches in our transportation bill that include a program that we're calling Transportation Leadership Awards, where money, a pot of money is set aside for creative, innovative approaches to transportation, similar to the Tiger program. And we want to help really launch that in our transportation bill. But we all ought to be mighty proud here for what we've done over the last 2 years. And we all ought to be mighty thankful that we had a president and a vice president who gave us the kind of latitude and opportunity to say to America, we'll help you get back to work. We'll help improve the economy. We did it. And I just want to say this. I don't know of any controversies with any of these projects. There may be some. But this was done by the book. No earmarks, no boondoggles, no sweetheart deals, no bad stories written about what we did. That's the other aspect of it. All the skeptics and all the cynics said, you can't do it. We did it. So thank you, sir, for the opportunity to do this, and thanks for your leadership. And this ought to be a celebration. That's what this ought to be. Thank you very much.
Well, Ray, thanks. That was you're overly generous, but it's a simple proposition. And a lot of you sat in those calls with me, those multiple calls with the governors and the senators and the local officials. And they say, gee, thanks for being so responsive. I think it's real simple. I said, if this doesn't work, I'm dead. So there's nothing like, as my father would say, giving somebody responsibility, laying it all on them, because it's the greatest incentive for it to work. I wasn't being generous. It was total self-defense. I want to make a brief closing comment. But, Sean, you had one more thing you wanted to add.
I just wanted to mention, Mr. Vice President, we've been working closely with your team and also with Secretary Vilsack. You had asked us to put together a report, each of us, to show how we're leading government into the future in a different way, how we've really devised new ways to help our urban economies, our cities around the country, and also our rural economies through the Recovery Act. I look forward into the coming weeks in presenting you with that report. Secretary Vilsack's going to do the same with his. Whether it's supporting 50,000 jobs in 40 urban school districts, allowing community health centers across the country to serve 1.7 million new patients, jump-starting the construction of hundreds of thousands of new affordable homes, where we know the construction industry lost 20% of its jobs in the downturn. The report is going to show how we have fundamentally changed the game for many of our cities around the country, including those that were suffering well before the crisis that hit us before you took office.
Well, I'm looking forward to those. It was your idea and Secretary Vilsack's idea, because I remember when Tom said, look, there is the most significant rural policy that we've ever implemented is sitting inside this Recovery Act. And you said, yeah, and there's also an urban policy here. And that's not how we sold. There was also an education policy, the single biggest lump sum investment in education. So you know, I guess what we all set out to do here is try to prove we could do something big well that had rippling effects on how we do business from here out. And I think you all have done that. And I think, look, this is self-serving on behalf of all of us, but I really think that we set out to do three things, and I think we've done it. You know, my grandfather used to have an expression. I'd say, Pop, can we do such and such? Can I do that? And he'd say, Joey, I don't think the horse can carry that sleigh. One horse, the sleigh's too heavy. Well, you know, I think we did not fundamentally. The Recovery Act wasn't designed to bring back the economy. We lost several trillion dollars in the economy, real loss. The idea that we could spend $800 billion, no matter how well we spent it, to, you know, fill in the deep hole we had been thrust into, we never advertised that. Unfortunately, it got confused in the public mind with everything from TARP to, you know, it was just all one big thing. But I know that when people look back on this 6 months from now, a year from now, and 10 years from now, they're going to realize that three things happened there can be no real argument about. This did stabilize the economy. Stabilize it. We were in free fall. This stabilized the economy. Two, as Secretary Chu laid out better than anybody has, this sort of began to build a platform for long-term growth in this country, looking at it a different way. I used to say there's no way I'd go out to audiences all across the country, this, the Middle Class Task Force. Anybody, please raise your hand, and I say this to the business audiences, you think we can lead in the 21st century the same energy policy we had in the 20th century? Not a single person raise their hand. Anybody think we can lead the world in the 21st century the same education policy we had in the 20th century? No one would raise their hand. Anybody think we can lead the world with the same degree of investment in research and development that we did the last 15 years? No one would raise their hand. So everybody really and truly in their gut knows that we had to break out. And I think we haven't done it all yet, but we began to lay the foundation for a 21st century economy, as the president said, where we can lead the world again. And the last thing that I think we did is what Earl said. I really do think, and I don't want to exaggerate the consequence of this, but I think we've made a substantial step forward in making government responsive and creating a new template where hopefully, 10 years from now, when there's a new president, Democrat or Republican, that when they say the government can do this, the immediate response from the public is, no, no, the government can't do anything. This is about instilling some confidence in the American people that we are not the economic engine, the free enterprise system is. We're not the ones, but that we can do the part of the job that we do well. And let me end by saying, and this is always a dangerous thing to quote a independent and substantial press person, because it probably embarrasses them. But I won't even mention the name. But Time magazine has a piece out this morning that had the following quote in it. It said, the Recovery Act helped avoid a depression, reduce the unemployment rate by 2%, cut taxes for 95% of Americans, bailed out every state to prevent mass layoffs, funded over 75,000 projects to upgrade roads, parks, sewers, and just about everything else, and made an unprecedented investment in renewable energy, health information technology, broadband, the smart grid, and much more, with no earmarks and virtually no fraud. As you might expect, I think that's an accurate assessment of what was done. Again, it's not the horse that carries the whole sleigh. We got a lot more work to do, but I'm really proud of y'all. And I don't know whether the main speakers have had time. I was supposed to have caught a plane a little while ago. The good news is, as Vice President, the plane doesn't leave till I get there, which at least I hadn't left yet. I wonder, and it's okay because I didn't warn you guys, if the principals could stay for 10 minutes or so and take a couple questions from the press, if they have any, about your areas. First of all, do the press have any questions about the Recovery Act and what we've done here? Good. Okay. Well, then we'll let it sit. And any questions you have, contact us, and we'll try to follow up on anything we said here. Again, great job. And Frank, thanks for taking over. You've done a good job bringing this to a close. And but the way I look at it, all kidding aside, I think it's kind of beginning a new way of doing business. So, Jack, you lucky devil. Congratulations. Thank you all very, very much for your cooperation. And the good news is I won't be calling these cabinet meetings as regularly.
Thank you.
Thanks.